This is PCJ Radio International.
Radio Berlin International.
Ici Radio Canada. This is Canada.
This is Radio Nederland, the Dutch World Broadcasting System in Hilversum, Holland.
You're tuned to Swiss Radio International in Bern.
This is Free China as a presentation of the Voice of Free China, the international service of the Broadcasting Corporation of China.
This is Radio Havana, Cuba.
Broadcasting from Cuba, free territory in the Americas.
This is Radio South Africa.
This is Yugoslavia Radio Belgrade calling.
This is Israel broadcasting from Jerusalem.
This is Radio Kenyan of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea.
This is the General Overseas Service of the BBC.
Friends and listeners, and welcome again to another edition of Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. Now, how many times have you turned on a television or radio and have heard headlines such as, "Don't eat too fast, then it's okay to eat too fast," "Don't eat carbohydrates after 6 p.m., then another report maybe a year later or even a shorter time saying, it's okay to eat carbohydrates," or "This food is bad for you, then this one is not good bad for you," and then the chances of developing, for example, Alzheimer's? Well, health reporting has become big business. Especially over the last 10 years, we've seen more and more of it on major news magazines around the world, including on local television stations. But there's one thing that a lot of people are raising the question of, and that is, how reliable is the research that is being released? Because we've seen this happen many times, that it's forever changing. One study comes out saying it's bad, another study coming out a few years later saying it's good. Well, there's a new book entitled Wrong: Why the Experts Keep Failing Us and How to Know When Not to Trust Them. It's by journalist and author David H. Friedman. And it's a fascinating book, kind of a how-to guide to health journalism. He speaks next to our friend Richard Ady.
This Thursday, a breakthrough in research into children's allergies.
I consume butter, I don't consume margarine.
British researchers have found an average television chef's recipe is not as healthy as a ready-to-eat.
Energy, protein, fat and saturated fat.
And a new review of an old study raises questions about the long-held view.
They used 5 cookbooks, including one by Jamie Oliver.
The risk factors have been hard to explain until now.
A new Australian study has found a link between breastfeeding in the first...
Polyunsaturated fats found in margarines are better for preventing heart disease than saturated fats.
It's bewildering trying to keep up with consumer health news via the media. You don't have to wait too long to hear or read contradictory reports on what you should eat, what you shouldn't, which exercise is good, which you shouldn't do. The end result is confusing and deeply unhelpful. David Friedman believes it's even worse than that. The longtime health and technology writer argues that the least reliable health research is what's reported. And the problem, he says, isn't caused by sloppiness.
I don't think accuracy is the problem. I think, in fact, a lot of it is quite accurate. In fact, that's really the problem. It's so accurate that what it's doing is it's transmitting wrong findings from scientific studies. It turns out that most scientific published findings don't, in fact, hold up over time. And so when science journalists transmit them accurately, they are, in effect, transmitting bad information to the world.
So you're talking about research findings that are in often quite prestigious publications, and they turn out to be, what, wrong?
Yeah, and of course, there's really wrong, as in flat-out wrong, and there's milder forms of wrong, such as exaggerated. The claims maybe hold up, but just not nearly as strongly as originally claimed. And yes, we're talking about an absolutely the tip of the pyramid when it comes to prestigious science journals. And the very best journals at least in medicine, you have close to a two-thirds wrongness rate, and it goes up in other journals.
But why is this?
It has to do with, really, at root, how tough science is, and in particular, how tough medical science is. Human beings are extremely complex. Biology is extremely complex. There are some easier problems in biology and health, and we've solved them all. And so what we're left with is the very toughest problems in a very difficult, messy science. And unfortunately, it's not easy for scientists to make a career out of coming out and saying, we don't know what's going on, we haven't really understood this yet. It's much easier to have a career as a scientist if you say, I have this definite finding. And that's what the publications look to publish, and that's what science journalists look to pass on.
Yeah, because you can imagine the publications, they want to publish the most interesting bits of research, don't they? And the most interesting bits of research are going to be the ones that are maybe counterintuitive or surprising.
That's exactly right. And it's a little hard to grasp this at first, but when you think about it, the reason something is surprising and interesting is typically because it's likely to be wrong. So if I tell you that I saw my cousin on the bus yesterday, you wouldn't find that a very interesting story. If I told you I spotted Elvis on the bus yesterday, well, that would be interesting, except you'd be pretty sure I'd be wrong about it. And this same simple phenomenon plays out in science. We like to hear the interesting stories. They're likely to be wrong.
So the scientists want to tell the most interesting stories, although they won't think of it that way. They'll think, well, I'll do this interesting research because it's more likely to be published. And then the publications are more likely to choose the most interesting of them, which means the health journalists are looking at the most interesting of the most interesting stories when it comes to deciding what they're going to write about and put in the paper or on TV.
That's right. And so what happens is science journalists aren't causing the problem of wrongness. They're essentially amplifying it. So we've got a problem right away with the science journals. So if the public read science journals, which of course most of them do not, they're very hard to read, then already we'd have a big problem. If science journalists are taking the most interesting, most novel, most provocative findings from those studies and giving those the most play in the media, then they are in effect picking the worst of the worst, and we get terrible health information.
How aware of this then are the health reporters? Because really, if they've been in it for more than a year or two, they ought to know this.
That's a difficult question to answer. Interestingly, scientists themselves are completely on board with this. I learned this from scientists. Scientists are very open about this. Science journalists are not so sure. I mean, after all, this is threatening their very enterprise, and a lot of them are quite defensive about it and don't seem to grasp it. Others say, well, of course we know this is true, but there's nothing we can do about it. I really disagree with that. I think there's a lot we can do about it.
But I'm not wrong in thinking, am I, that there is a real tendency to report the latest research as if it's the complete truth. That's it. Game over. No more discussion. We now know everything about this.
You see that a lot, and that is just absolutely the worst way to report any sort of scientific finding, or almost any sort of scientific finding, especially within medicine, where we know there is such high wrongness rates. So all these results really should be published with a lot of qualifiers and with a general spirit of, hey, this is perhaps interesting. It could turn out to be right, although chances are pretty good it'll just be one more finding that won't quite get it right, but we can just take it as one more data point.
It explains why ordinary readers who are interested in health get confused about things, especially things like coffee, red wine, losing weight.
So a lot of bad things happen when people read this stuff. There are a number of choices that readers can make when they're presented with this stuff. They can latch on to one of them because they find it the best solution for their lifestyle and just become believers in it, and chances are they've latched on to a bad solution that will not help their health. On the other hand, they can sort of go the opposite route, see all the conflicting results, and then say, well, I give up. I guess scientists don't really get this at all. There's nothing I can do. And that's a bad attitude, too. It's not their fault, but that's really not the best way to deal with your health.
I know you're especially interested in obesity. Big problem in your country, big problem in this one too, and the way it's reported across the media. I can't, off the top of my head, name the different number of diet approaches that have been canvassed in the media as perhaps the answer over the last 4 or 5 years.
And not only have we seen just this massive stream of supposed diet solutions, all backed, mind you, by scientific studies, come at the public, you have a lot of science journalists, sometimes backed by scientists, who will absolutely declare that they have the answer and everybody else is wrong. I think this is absolutely appalling that science journalists are taking part in this sort of debacle because obesity is killing people. It's robbing the planet of millions and millions of person years of life. And it's a serious problem. There are solutions to it. And we really shouldn't be latching on to some of these silly, faddish solutions that are pitched by some science journalists.
So where does that leave us with regard to, because in this country, our National Health and Medical Research Council has published the latest dietary guidelines this week. It's a bit of a change. Of course, the media is enthusiastically reporting them. Should we be taking them with a grain of salt?
Well, better a grain of salt than a blob of fat, I guess. But I think what we've seen is dietary guidelines that have shifted a lot over the years. In many ways, they've almost reversed from what we were hearing as late as the 1990s. But I do think it's true we're slowly zooming in on a better set of dietary guidelines. The evidence is piling in. Consensus is slowly building. We do have a much better idea now of the kind of diets, first of all, that are likely to help us from being obese, and second of all, and this is critical, that people are likely to be able to stick with. Now, that's a critical distinction that a lot of science journalists and scientists fail to make, which is a healthy diet that will keep us from being obese is useless if most people won't be able to stick with it. So we're getting better guidelines now, and I think people do need to pay attention to them.
What should health and science journalists be doing? What should they be doing better that they're not doing now?
I do think that science journalists do need to keep accurately reporting the results of scientific studies for the simple reason of what else can we do? We can't outthink the scientists on this one. However, I think we should constantly be reminding our readership that much as you have a warning on every pack of cigarettes, there should be a warning, essentially, that comes with science journalism articles that remind the readers, scientists are doing their best to get at very difficult answers, and along the way, most of what they come up with typically doesn't hold up. So pay attention. Maybe there's something interesting here, but don't jump onto the wagon of believing this is going to be the solution that will solve anything. And now they don't literally have to say all that, but that should be the spirit of the reporting as opposed to latest study finds, now we know the answer. That really can be deadly advice.
But that's the equivalent of having a disclaimer saying, this may turn out to be completely wrong. No journalist is going to want to do that.
And any journalist who does is going to have a serious conversation with their editor or producer who's going to say, and you want me to run this? Why? And as a matter of fact, I think what has to happen is science journalists have to call on their creativity as writers, as reporters, to find a way to sell this story, to continue to publish these stories and make them interesting, even though they're not sold as the honest-to-God bottom-line truth.
It happens in other areas, in other beats or rounds, doesn't it? We don't pretend that actually this is carved in stone and you don't need to ever read anything else about this. We always make it clear that this is part of something that's evolving and changing over time.
Frustratingly to me, some of the realms in which we're most skeptical, such as, for example, the business world, and especially the world of politics, reporters do a great job of being very skeptical. Of course, we expect that of our reporters in politics and business. It's ironic that in the world of science, where we should really be doing a great job of not misleading our readers and trying to get them as close to the truth as we can, where we have journalists who don't bring that sort of skepticism and those sorts of qualifications to their reportings for the most part. And that really needs to change.
I wonder if, though, that's because science has been a robust and effective way of answering questions about ourselves and the universe. And that means that the journalists have almost forgotten that they have to be skeptical as well, because the scientists have already done the skepticism for them.
I think what happens is that most science journalists are not scientists. They typically might have a college degree, an undergraduate degree, as we say here in the U.S., in science. And so what they've done is they've learned science from textbooks and lectures. If you continue on and get your PhD and become a genuine working scientist, you do research, and lo and behold, you learn how messy and frequently, in fact, most of the time, wrong science is. And so scientists have really no problem with this. Science journalists have a much bigger problem. And so, yes, they themselves either forget or don't really understand, never did quite grasp that science really is not typically very effective at getting at the truth on very complex subjects. It may be the best way we have of getting at it, but it's still not a great one. It doesn't really turn up the right answers most of the time.
So actually what you want is a big change in how scientists and health researchers are regarded by health journalism. Instead of infallible heroes, more flawed humans. It's a very human enterprise, science.
Well, and that seems like a simple, very palatable point to make. I mean, who wants to claim that scientists aren't human beings like the rest of us? And yet you really do see a very strong element in science reporting of treating the people we cover as our sacred heroes, who would never mislead us, who are the sacred givers of the truth. Scientists don't see themselves that way. They never talk about themselves that way, or almost never. And it's really silly for us science journalists to do the same. But one of the things I like to point out is that science journalists are just about the only kinds of journalists who brag about getting awards from the people they cover. I think that's great to get an award, but come on, what does that say about conflict of interest, about skepticism and wariness of who we're covering?
That was David Friedman, the author of a new book called Wrong, Why the Experts Keep Failing Us, and How to Know When Not to Trust Them. And that was a look at health reporting. He was speaking there, by the way, with our good friend Richard Ady. You're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. One source of information for the program is actually from you, the listener, and also people that contribute to the program, for example, like Andy Sennett, who does it from time to time. Now, very often on our Facebook page, we get interesting items about radio that are posted that sometimes, well, it's a bit good for comic relief. Like this one. On January the 4th, at 1800 hours, BBC Radio 4 had a bit of a glitch, shall we say. The news was supposed to come on. Instead, for 9 minutes, the continuity announcer had to come back after the occasional promo to keep saying, well, we hope the news will return. We found an edited version of the 9 minutes, and we thought we'd bring it to you now to explain the kind of things that can go wrong with a live broadcast. And then you'll understand why we'll play it after we come back.
Well, that was very nice to hear from Big Ben, but we would like to hear the news. We'll bring it to you just as soon as we can.
Within the BBC, we all call from our own correspondent, just Fook.
And I'm our correspondent, Saturday mornings at 11:30 on BBC Radio 4.
This is BBC Radio 4, where I'm afraid we're having some technical problems which are preventing us from continuing with our scheduled programme as smoothly as we'd wish. Many apologies for the disruption to your listening, but rest assured we're doing our best to restore normal service as soon as possible.
Hello and welcome to Loose Ends.
A bit of this.
With a particularly happy, talented, entertaining and...
Dave Anderson presents Loose Ends every Saturday evening at 6:15. This is Radio 4, where, as you may have gathered, we're still suffering some technical problems and can't bring you our scheduled programme at the moment. In the meantime, let me remind you of what you can find on the BBC Radio 4 website. The address is bbc.co.uk/radio4, where you'll discover a wide range of features to help you enjoy our output. You can listen to all Radio 4 programmes from the past 7 days. Many are permanently archived, so you can listen and explore years' worth of programmes, such as Desert Island Discs, In Our Time, The Food Programme, Book Club, Woman's Hour, Today and many more. Well, now I'm glad to say that we can return to the 6 o'clock news with Susan Ray. Well, we are having a few problems here. We obviously can't return to the 6 o'clock news at the moment. I'll do my best to see what's happening. Pictures and biographies. And finally, for the very latest highlights on our station, why not sign up for the weekly Radio 4 newsletter? Those are just some of the many things you can find by going to bbc.co.uk/Radio 4. And while our website remains in good health, I'm afraid we're still having problems bringing you our scheduled programmes at the moment. Please bear with us. We are working as fast as possible to solve the problem. We can't always listen to the radio when we'd like, so that means we're bound to miss some great Radio 4 programmes. But so you can listen whenever and wherever you like. Find out more on the BBC Radio 4 website. We're still having a few technical difficulties. Please do stay with us. We're trying to sort it out just as soon as we can.
The Mints. M-I-N-T. Mexico, Indonesia, Nigeria and Turkey.
Are these the new economic powerhouses? Mornings at 9.
And over the course of a week, the economist Jim O'Neill visits Mexico, Indonesia, Nigeria and Turkey to shine a light on life in these countries as they teeter on the cusp of potential economic greatness.
The Mint.
Sugar. We all know too much is bad for us, but is one type worse than all the others? In Fructose, the bittersweet sugar. The bittersweet sugar on Wednesday at 9 p.m.
This is BBC Radio 4. As you can hear, we're having quite a few problems at the moment bringing you the 6 o'clock news. Until then, another trail.
It's Africa's largest city, the commercial hub of Nigeria. From London and Lagos, the Today programme on Monday morning at 6, here on BBC Radio 4.
In addition to this, across the week, Women's Hour and Front Row will feature reports from these four countries. While on Monday morning, the Today programme comes from Lagos, where Evan Davis will be looking at Nigeria's economic development. That's on Monday morning from 6. On digital radio, online, on FM and on Longwave, this is BBC Radio 4. When it comes to castaways, few are better equipped to survive on a desert island than my guest this week.
First of all, you should stop. Someone might come looking for you. There's a good chance that you should build some signals ready in case somebody comes.
This is BBC Radio 4. We're still having a few problems here. We're getting back to the news very shortly. I really do hope so. Let's have a try now. This is BBC Radio 4, and now hopefully we can go to the 6 o'clock news with Susan Ray.
Good evening. The Iraqi government has lost control of Fallujah, a major city west of Baghdad, after days of fighting and more than 100 deaths. The city is in Anbar, the only Iraqi province.
And that was an edited version of the 9 minutes on BBC Radio 4 at 6 o'clock, where the news were supposed to be there, but they heard Big Ben and then nothing else. Good job, by the way, from the continuity reader. I've seen this kind of thing happen before. I remember a number of years ago watching a television continuity announcer, an InVision, as they would say in the UK, and it was an automated camera system. So this person came on, said, oh, coming up at this time, this time, this time, and now we're going to go to this movie. Well, the camera stayed on him and stayed live for about 2 minutes. Now, that's what you call a long time in television. 2 minutes doesn't seem like a long time, but when a camera's on you for 2 minutes and you have nothing to say, it can seem like a lifetime. Now, there is a reason for playing that. Those who listen to PCJ Radio on a regular basis know that over the past couple of weeks, we've been doing our Sunday transmissions live. We've added a second one. Now, for those listening to this show on the 11th, if it's, say, after 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning,
there's no point to pay attention. But for those who are listening to this, let's say on Friday, the 10th of January, well, we have a special one-hour live transmission Saturday from 13:30 to 14:30 UTC on 11880 kHz broadcasting to North America. That's 13:30 to 14:30 UTC on 11880 kHz. And of course, your reception reports are going to be greatly appreciated. You can listen to the program to find out the details, how to send it to us by email or by snail mail. Now, the program lineup will be the following. Focus Asia Pacific with Andy Sennett. Then at 13:45, another edition of Media Network Plus, a live program, which will last for approximately 30 minutes. And then at 14:15 UTC, Bob Zanotti will be joining us for Switzerland in Sound. So, January the 11th from 13:30 to 14:30 UTC, tune in to hear a special live edition of Media Network Plus here on PCJ Radio International. You can find all the details at our website, www.pcjmedia.com. Well, let's now turn our attention to propagation and what we can expect over the next 7 days. Here's our good friend, Dan Hensley.
Here's propagation from January 11th, 2014 to January 17th, 2014. A 10.7 centimeter flux starts out on January 11th at 205, down to 200 on January 12th, January 13th also 200, January 14th 195, January 15th 175, January 16th 155, January 17th 150. The A index starts out on January 11th at 8 and then steady at 5 all week long from January 12th to January 17th. The KP index starts out at 3 on January 11th, 2014, then drops down to 2 steady all week long from January 12th to January 17th. 4 sunspots are seen this week, 1944, 46, 48, and 49. 1944 is a really large and active spot that has already caused an X-flare to spew out directly towards Earth on January 9, 2014. Solar wind flowing from this emerging coronal hole should reach Earth on January 12 to 13th. For more information, see our website at www.pcjmedia.com/rprop.
All right, thank you very much, Dan. Well, guess what? We're now out of time. Dan Hensley will be joining us during the live program to talk about some other things as well. So do tune in Saturday, 13:30 to 14:30 UTC on 11835 for North America for a live edition of the program. If you wish to contact us to let us know what you think, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is mnp@pcjmedia.com. That's mnp@pcjmedia.com. And of course, don't forget to visit our website, pcjmedia.com/Media Network Plus, all one word. So until next time, friends, I'm Keith Perron wishing you well. We'll see you again very soon. Until next time, so long, take care. 73 and 88 to the ladies.